It began with the forging of the great pharmacokinetic tables. One was given over to absorption, that the wisest and fairest of all doctors could use highly bioavailable agents. Another to the lords of distribution, great craftsmen of dosing regimens. And lastly, elimination was gifted to the race of pharmacists who above all else desire prompt excretion. For within these tables was bound the strength and will to prescribe antibiotics correctly. But they were all of them deceived. For another table was made. In the land of morons, in the fires of Mount Notion, the Dark Lord Jame forged in secret a master table composed of all others. One table to rule them all.
Jim, Sauron didn't laugh.
All right, just play the theme tune, Callum.
Soon may the editing come to discontinue the Tezo Sun. One day when the CRP's done, we'll take our leave and go.
Callum, how you doing?
I'm feeling Galadriel to see you.
Well, that's good, actually. A surprising difference from the norm.
This is our Lord of the Rings themed episode. Oh, wait, sorry, pharmacokinetics.
Pharmacokinetics, our favourite thing in the world. And here I've got, for you, Callum, a thing of beauty.
Jame has a fur child.
One that I love just as much as the other two, let's say no more than that. But yeah, I've taken all of the stuff that we've been talking about over the last three episodes and I've smooshed it all together into one antibiotic pharmacokinetics table to rule them all.
So Jame, we've just done three episodes on pharmacokinetics, which is your favourite subject. And I just wondered if people haven't listened to those last three episodes, why not? And then what is it that we've summarised here? What are we talking about?
So we're talking about the pharmacokinetics of all antibiotics that are in common use, let's say, in the UK and, you know, to a lesser extent in Europe in general. And this will be of use to people who are working in, you know, comparable healthcare systems. And we've, you know, we've had episodes on absorption, distribution, metabolism and excretion. And I've got the data as far as I could get it from those three tables, and I have smooshed them together into one table to rule them all. And so starting with absorption, distribution, protein binding, metabolism, excretion, clearance, and half-life for every antibiotic that is available in the UK. Yeah, so I've kept the traffic light colour coding for bioavailability, and then hydrophilic versus lipophilic. And then the rest of it, there's not a lot of colour in it, to be honest with you. But yeah.
Yeah. So what's the purpose of, why have you done this?
Well, it's, you know, I'm mindful that the previous three episodes, this data has been presented in sort of multiple different tables in the prep notes, and we've discussed them separately. I thought it would be good to actually have it all available in one place as a reference. And I've also got down there at the bottom a copy of the table as an Excel spreadsheet for download. So if you want to steal this and modify it according to your own wishes, then you may do so. And the link to do that is in the prep notes for this episode.
Instead of a dark lord, you could have a queen, dark and terrible as a knight.
Indeed you could, Callum. Treacherous as the sea. Ah, yeah, I've seen the movies. But yeah, the purpose for it is to use as a resource for other people so that they can improve their knowledge about the pharmacokinetics of these drugs and therefore how they're best used.
It's very helpful of you. Thank you. I'm going to use this table.
Are you? You're going to use it to win fights?
Fight! Fight in the world. I would never have a fight, but indeed. I might use
it. If you did, this would be very helpful.
I might use it in discussions.
Polite discussions with colleagues, yes, I'm sure.
You're making me sound like some sort of tyrant. So the table has got a lot of useful information in it. And as James says, we all the way back a couple of months ago started talking about from a very basic level about how to choose an antibiotic. And this becomes very complicated very quickly. And I'll admit that there's some stuff that we've discussed in the last couple of episodes that I do struggle to get my head around understanding it. Although this is quite complicated, it does sort of help when you're thinking about using antibiotics, thinking about, you know, maybe why. I was recently reading the BIA meningitis guidance, which is a really great resource and well laid out. And one of the questions I had reading it was, why ceftriaxone? Like in the UK, certainly, and in lots of places, someone presents with meningitis, I think almost every doctor in the UK would know that you treat meningitis with ceftriaxone. It's so embedded in our practice. And then it got me thinking, why is that the drug? And going back to some of the literature and Cochrane reviews of ceftriaxone versus older therapy options like amox or menpen and chloramphenicol. But there's not that much like clinical data, but there's a line in the BIA guidance and it talked about this is recommended based on the pharmacokinetics. I thought it was really interesting. I was like, whoa. Because I guess sometimes we practice medicine in a way that is like guidelines say jump, so I jump.
Mm-hmm.
But when you dig into where there isn't data, I think a lot of the times things are leaning on pharmacokinetics, and that is the basis by which we practice. Like if you're in an area where you don't have a clinical, you know, I think nobody would disagree that a randomized controlled trial that's well conducted is the highest form of evidence, and that's what you'll base your treatment decisions on. But, you know, if you're in an evidence-free area, then this is what you're going to come back to, isn't it? It's the pharmacokinetics.
Yeah, if you know it.
Well, you're about to find out.
Well, will we go through some of the winners and losers, Callum?
Yeah, so I guess not everybody will have the table in front of them. Recommend if you go on to your podcast player choice in the show notes, there'll be a link to a Notion page, which is a sort of website that James has been putting lots of lovely show notes on. And in there, you'll find the table and really recommend if you're driving, maybe after your journey, if you're doing something else, just have a wee look at the table and maybe come back to it later on. So, yes, yeah, so we've got some things to pick out when we're talking about pharmacokinetics of different drug classes.
Yeah, so I think first we need to... I've sort of divided this into highest and lowest, and let's start with bioavailability. So our highest, most bioavailable drugs are levofloxacin and linezolid, which are functionally 100% absorbed. Our lowest are fosfomycin and erythromycin, which are about, you know, a third each in terms of bioavailability, so not very much there. This is good knowledge, I feel, because that makes me increasingly doubtful of the utility of giving IV linezolid, say, to anybody whose oral route isn't compromised or they don't have septic shock.
Really ever given that?
Well, when people are thinking about using linezolid, I think some people would still start IV and then oral switch.
Really?
And I'm more and more of that idea. Yeah, if you were using, say, for example, you were using it in, you were replacing clindamycin with linezolid in necrotizing fasciitis guidance.
Oh, and that kind of works, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a big position paper about that came out a few months ago. And I think, actually, in that case, if you've got somebody who's got neck fash, fine, get it in IV, first couple of doses at least. After that, post-opsy, assuming that they've been to take in the theatre and debrided, I'm not sure what good that's doing unless you actually think that the gut is compromised. And certainly if you're using it for a severe cellulitis or even a cellulitis with shock, but they don't have neck fash, as long as their mouth is working, I think it's perfectly okay to give it.
I think I would go further and say, you know, in that sort of situation, you know, you're probably giving quite a few different drugs and there's a lot going on. The time, you know, you've probably got limited access. You may be giving a concoction of different antimicrobials. I just give the linezolid orally and get it in, get it started working quicker.
Mm.
You know,
perhaps,
only as an IV infusion take.
Well, indeed. And you could actually co-administer a highly bioavailable oral drug with IV as well. And some would argue that would be better. Yeah. But, and then the other thing I'll point out is that the erythromycin. This is a bit of a historical thing, Callum, but that bioavailability and combined with pretty high volume of distribution, the early endocarditis management was done with penicillin, and that got about a 70% success rate. And as a reminder, endocarditis was 100% fatal functionally before the introduction of antimicrobials. People tried sulfonamide antibiotics as well, so cousins of sulfamethoxazole, but they have pretty high MICs to the target organisms, the streps and staphs. So they very quickly were like, that's not very useful. And then they moved to macrolides. They tried to treat endocarditis with erythromycin, and they got a like 25% success rate. And they were like, that's not nearly as good as penicillin, and so we're just going to stick with penicillin.
Yeah, it must be because erythromycin is bacteriostatic. That must be the reason.
Ugh, don't even get me started, Callum. But that, what I just discussed, is the only evidence in the literature for oral being inferior to IV. That anecdotal data comparing penicillin IV with something that had high MICs against the target organism, or something with a high volume of distribution that doesn't get good plasma levels. That's the only, and even then it had a 25% success rate.
This is kind of crazy, it actually worked at all, isn't it?
This is infuriating. But anyway, yeah, it is crazy that it worked at all. And, you know, I'm certainly not suggesting that we use macrolides for endocarditis now.
No.
But that is the only evidence for IV being superior to oral. And I think, I'm sure you could agree, that's pretty shoddy evidence. And just about every observational study, case series, and four RCTs and counting, providing evidence, you know, just in the field of endocarditis, I'm not talking about anything else, that orals are non-inferior to IVs. So next we have protein binding, and it will be no surprise that our number one is dalbavancin with 93 to 99% protein binding. It's highly protein bound. And as a reminder, only the free component is active, but only the free component is excreted as well. So if you give 1,500 milligrams of dalbavancin, you know, 96% of that will be stuck to albumin, and then the remaining 4% will be having the effect on the target organism and getting peed out at any one time. And this contributes to its very long half-life.
Yeah, it's pretty long, isn't it?
Yeah, and then our lowest would probably be amikacin with 0 to 11% protein binding. And the aminoglycosides in general are not very protein bound, which sort of explains why they're quite toxic, because there's virtually no component. If they're floating around in plasma, there's virtually no bit of the drug that's not free to bind to the target organism, and might explain why they've got concentration-dependent killing, as opposed to, say, you know, time over MIC, which you would get with the beta-lactams.
But if you're saying that's because of the low protein binding, what about meropenem, which is very lowly protein bound at 2%?
Yeah, I mean, the protein binding mero is quite low, certainly compared to ertapenem, which is, we've discussed before, is quite high, over 85% protein bound. And that means that in low albumin states, more of the dose that you give will be excreted in a shorter period of time, and people have hypothesized that this has led to ertapenem failures in the intensive care population.
So that's high and low protein binding. What about volume of distribution?
Well, you've mentioned on the relevant episode that azithromycin is the runaway winner there with a volume of distribution of 2,177 liters. So virtually none of that is staying in the plasma. It's distributing out to the tissues and into the intracellular space. And then the runner-up is tigecycline with a VD of about 500 to 600. And then the, well, not losers, but just, you know, this is just, they just don't want to leave the plasma particularly, would be keflexin with a VD of 5.2 to 5.8 liters and daptomycin with 7.
So thinking about daptomycin for just a second as a drug in itself. So this is a drug that's highly protein bound at 90 to 93% and has a very low volume of distribution at 7. And I was rereading the infective endocarditis guidance. I guess that, you know, that sort of combination there makes me think, oh, that'd be good for intravascular infections. It kind of makes sense that might be a good, you know, thing to use against your infective endocarditis.
And low rate of clearance as well. presumably because of the high protein binding.
Yeah.
But and all this is true of Dalbavancin as well. You see that they sort of follow each other through these tables.
Dalbavancin
clearance is very low at 0.9 mils a minute.
I guess we just don't really have the data yet to support that, but...
I'm not suggesting that we'd use it for endocarditis. Yeah. Not for nothing. It's a glycopeptide, so it's definitely not my first choice for endocarditis treatment. But yeah, but they sort of are very pharmacokinetically are quite similar to each other. They've got high levels of protein binding, low rates of clearance, and daptomycin has a very small volume of distribution, let's say.
So just going on to clearance, as you mentioned it, so kind of continuing the theme, so azithromycin is very highly cleared at 630 mils per minute, and our lowest level is dalbavancin at 0.9. I don't think there's any surprises there. And then half-life, so again, on one end, we've got dalbavancin at the highest half-life at 346 hours. And interestingly, azithromycin isn't at the lower end, so it's actually got a really long half-life at 68. So I guess you can contrast there the half-life of dalbavancin and the half-life of azithromycin, which are very different pharmacokinetics and very different reasons. So dalbavancin's half-life is very long because it's highly bound to the protein and just doesn't get cleared because there's not the sort of free drug ready to be cleared. Azithromycin has a very long half-life because none of it's in the serum to get cleared. It's just not there. So it's kind of having to diffuse. It diffuses out into the tissues and then slowly comes out of the tissues back into the serum, which allows it to be cleared.
Yeah. So there's two ways that you can have a long half-life. One is by being very highly protein-bound and very little of you is free in the plasma. And the other is that you can leave the plasma altogether. And so the dalbavancin and azithromycin are two examples of that strategy, if you can give a drug a strategy, to have a long half-life, And then the lowest half-life drugs are, it will come as no surprise, penicillin is our number one, an average of about half an hour. So this is why you have to dose penicillin if you're using it so many times a day to the frustration of the administrator of the drug, and why a lot of people would default to amoxicillin, which has a longer half-life of about an hour, which means you can give it four times a day or so for a serious infection and not annoy the nurses quite so much.
Yeah, so that's some outliers. Maybe to finish, we could just take one drug and go all the way through its journey in the body.
Well, I think we should use, just as an example, maybe cotrimoxazole.
Okay, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, down at the bottom. So what I've done then is I've sort of tried to summarize the characteristics of each antimicrobial by drug class, so starting with the beta-lactams and going down to the antifolate drugs at the end, just to give people a very kind of rough idea. And I sort of talk about their absorption, distribution, metabolism, excretion, and half-life. But maybe just as an example, we'll talk about cotrimoxazole, the antifolate drugs. Yeah, Cal?
Yeah, so we'll just take you on a journey. I don't know, this is going to be a very niche reference that most people probably won't get, but there was this amazing program and turned into a game called the Magic School Bus.
At this point in the episode, Calum started talking about a Magic School Bus TV show that I'd never heard of and that I'm not sure anybody else did. So instead, just think about that episode of Rick and Morty where they go inside the person and they explore the body and it's been made into a theme park. There we go.
I think that's a reference to it. I actually just Googled the game and I found a way you can play it online for free. So I guess I know what I'm doing.
All right. Well done.
I need to learn about the human body. So...
yeah, so cotrimoxazole is an interesting one because it's got two components, trimethoprim, molecular weight 290 Daltons, and sulfamethoxazole, 253 Daltons. Now, luckily enough, both of them are reasonably lipophilic and reasonably bioavailable, so greater than 90% absorption for both of those. And then in terms of protein binding, they're very similar, sort of 44% for trimethoprim, 70% for sulfamethoxazole. So you would call them sort of medium protein binding, and their volume of distribution is 30 liters for sulfa and 25 for trimethoprim. So again, they're not all that far away from each other in terms of where they're going and what they're doing. So they're, if you think about our 70 kilogram male, Callum, 13 liters is not all that much more than plasma. assuming that you've got about 3.5 to 5 liters of plasma within you. So it's not leaving the plasma all that much. And the same with trimethoprim, VD of 25. Again, it's not, it's what, maybe a third of your body weight. So it's mostly staying in the plasma. In terms of metabolism, they are both metabolized to inactive metabolites by CYP2C9 and trimethoprim by CYP3A4. So this is one that metabolizes most, or 60% of all drugs. And they're excreted renally, 55% for TRIM and 85% for sulfa. And this is good as far as we are concerned for treating UTIs, because it then means that you get these massive levels. And because cotrimoxazole's PD parameter is AUC over MIC, you'll get lots and lots of kill with urinary tract infection. Clearance of 50 to 90 and 20 mils per minute respectively. And then half-lives, very similar, 8 to 10 hours for each.
It's quite long.
Yeah, well, that's what allows for sort of BD dosing, is that long half-life. And if you compare to other stuff, so once you get above 10 hours, you can tend towards once-a-day dosing. So, for example, say cyclin's half-life is 12 hours. So if you're a sufficient number above the MIC of your target organism, so say you load with 200 milligrams and you'll get a plasma level of about, say, 4, well, the MIC of streptococci against doxycycline is sort of, for a lot of them, it's 1. So if you think, if you're going from 4, one half-life will get you to 2, another half-life would get you to 1, and then you would dose them with another 100 milligrams.
Yeah.
You know? And so then you're back up again to, you know, 3 or 4 or something like that. And so you can stay above the MIC almost indefinitely. So that's the explanation why with doxy you would do a 200 milligram load and then give 100 milligrams once a day. Depending on your trust, you might be giving 100 milligrams twice a day. And so then you're given 100 milligrams every 12 hours, which is only one half-life. So functionally, you'll be permanently above the MIC for the whole course if you do that. All right, so NAIDOS Royal Infirmary South does that, mostly because we can't get our e-prescribing system to play nicely with the 200 load and then the 100 on days 2, 3, 4, and 5. But yeah, so like once your half-life is, you know, that high, it sort of depends on what your PD target is. You know, for beta-lactams, if your time over MIC target is 40%, you may, you know, get away with 2 or 3 times a day dosing with, say, you know, PIP/TAZ. So, but say if you're treating a Pseudomonas, your PD target is 60 to 70%, you would need to move up to 4 times a day. And that's why PIP/TAZ is dosed 4 times a day for Pseudomonas.
So all this pharmacodynamic stuff that James is talking about, so we've just done a mini series on pharmacokinetics. And I think often when we talk about this, we say PK and PD, and then we don't really talk about it more. So I think there will be a mini series on pharmacodynamics coming up, but we're going to do something else for a bit before we do that, please.
What? Okay, fine, Callum. I heard you loud and clear. You want a break, but it is coming.
It is coming. So we'll come back to pharmacodynamics. So that's a worked example. So, you know, I guess we've gone through the table. We've given you a couple of top trumps, and James has neatly summarized it and given us in the show notes some reflections on the different drug classes and what they mean. And I guess the way I think I'm going to use this as a listener is I'm going to, when I'm thinking about, you know, drug options or complicated situations or things outside evidence areas, and then I'm probably going to come back to this and use it to think about part of my sort of thought process, I guess, about how to choose an antibiotic.
Yeah, good. And that's how it's intended. I think certainly as a clinical pharmacologist, I've been wanting to create something like this table for years, just to kind of like get it all in one place. Because the trouble is that all this data is spread across SPCs, and you know, you can look up individual drugs in, you know, in drugbank.ca, for example, and you know, UCAS has some brilliant documents on these drugs, and you know, wherever possible, I've tried to pull the PK data from there, particularly the bioavailability and half-life data. But you know, at the end of the day, you were always able to access individual drugs, but actually getting all of them together was like a major hassle. And in fact, looking back on this project, I should have just made this table and then talked about the individual components, because I didn't do that. I made three different tables and then I smooshed them together. I probably shouldn't have done that.
I think it's a quite complicated subject, so I found it helpful to sort of split it up into bite-sized chunks and then split them together like side chains onto a beta lat-time ring.
Yeah, just so. That's exactly the analogy I was about to.
I guess now we've got, James, we've got your one table to rule them all after we've had our one James finding all the data from all over the internet and bringing them all and binding them together.
Am I meant to agree? Yes, yes.
Yes. Thanks, James, for all your hard work on this, and I'll certainly be using it in my practice.
Thanks, Callum. Thanks for doing absolutely nothing for this entire mini-series.
Oh, what?
All right. See you next week.
What? Thank you for listening to the Idiots Podcast, the UK's premier infectious disease podcast. We are supported by the British Infection Association, but they do not have creative control over the episode content, so please don't blame them if we get something wrong.
Questions, comments, suggestions? Why don't you send them in to idiotspodcasting@gmail.com. Have a 5-star review in your pocket? Calum and I would love to have it. Please drop it in your podcast player of choice. We tweet at @idiots_pod. And if you want to donate to support the show, there's a link to do so in the description. But until next time, I'm James.
I'm Calum.
See you then.
Now that the episode's done, we hope you learned and had lots of fun. So go forth and treat people with some of what you now know.